You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity service and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. So today we're going to talk about philanthropic advising and arts organizations with someone who knows quite a bit about both of those areas, having spent much of her career doing both of those. She is a philanthropic advisor working with families and wealth advisors. She's an adjunct at the University of Chicago's Booth School for Business in their private wealth management program. She's also an adjunct at Johns Hopkins in sports and entertainment certificate program. She's built and is teaching a master's course at Tulane called the Foundation of Strategic Philanthropy. She currently chairs the board of the Poetry Foundation in Chicago. She's also a member of the Board of Visitors of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at IU and the Women's Philanthropy Institute. Previously, she served as the executive director of the Oprah Winfrey Foundations, and she was also the president of the Crown Family Philanthropies. With me today is my longtime friend, Karen Yanis. Karen, it's just great to have you, and thank you for joining me today on the Heart of Giving podcast.
Art, it's such a pleasure to be here. I love the fact that this is called Heart of Giving, because that just brings the level of compassion and engagement together with how important it is to do giving wisely. And also just thinking about your website and how you focus both on helping donors give wisely and helping charities build trust. Those are such important things. It's really an honor to be here with you today.
Well, Karen, let's jump right in. First of all, tell us about what a philanthropic advisor does.
Well, philanthropic advisors work in lots of different ways. I like to think about advisors as being the liaisons between resource and need. And you know, Bryan Stevenson put this so beautifully in his book, Just Mercy, where he talks about the importance of being proximate. Advisors help high net worth, ultra high net worth clients build empathy and discover their own purpose, and at the same time, really commit themselves to creating some changes in the world.
What type of other advisors do you work with, and why do they need to know about organized giving?
You know, this is such an interesting and kind of bespoke space. So wealth advisors advise clients all the time about how to increase their wealth. They're more and more thinking about how to help clients stay engaged by increasing their purpose. And so they're doing that through ESG, environment, social, and governance lenses on investing, but they're also connecting their clients to estate planners and insurance brokers who can help the clients think about how to leave a beneficiary for an insurance policy. And that beneficiary may be a nonprofit organization or a cause with a frame for how to focus on that cause. Estate planners often call me and say, I have a client who's decided that they want to leave a significant amount of money to women in Africa. How do I do that? Right. And so there are these really big questions. And at the heart of those questions is, what is donor intent? What do donors truly want to do? And an advisor can kind of hold their hand and help guide them through a maze of opportunities and issues and help them think about what problems they want to solve in the world before they think about making individual donations. And then to do it strategically and to do it really well.
I would agree. I think strategy is really important in giving. What type of individuals are we talking about here that actually need philanthropic advisors, and why do they need them?
My clients are typically at an inflection point, and that means they're ready to think about going to that next level in developing a governance model for their philanthropy. High net worth, ultra high net worth families don't really have any natural predators. It's not like market forces are making a huge difference in the way that they're thinking about their philanthropy. It may make a difference in how much they have for philanthropy, but really the rules are set by the families and by the IRS. But frankly, if a family doesn't have isn't maintaining a really good level of compliance, they don't have the right advisors helping them do that, because that's low-hanging fruit. That's something that everybody should be able to do. But the boundary, some families call them bumpers, of how do we make decisions together, can have an enormous effect on the family at large. There are two inflection points that tend to happen around families that search out advisors and families that are really interested in upping their giving. And that's a liquidity event. So someone has spent their life building a business. They've put their heart and soul into the business. They care about their employees. They care about the community. And all of a sudden, they sell the business for more than they ever thought they were going to get. In the meantime, they were raising family. And the family, the children had access to a lot more resources than they probably did when they were growing up. And sometimes that creates a disconnect. So all of a sudden, someone's sold their business and they're no longer in the thick of things in their business. Their purpose has changed, and they've got an investment company, essentially. They're investing their resources, and that may not have been what drove them in their business. So all of a sudden, they have an opportunity to think bigger and think about engaging their family. So liquidity is one, and life cycle is another. So someone dies, there's a divorce. And divorce is really big. Often women have the opportunity after a divorce to think more about philanthropy and think about financial issues in ways that they hadn't had an opportunity to before. Sometimes it's when people are born into the family or when someone gets married and a spouse comes in and says, wow, you have all these resources. How are you shepherding them? What are you doing? And then becomes the catalyst for an advisor to come in.
Karen, how do you advise families about the right structure when they want to give together? You mentioned that oftentimes families have these inflection points, but maybe they haven't thought about who's in charge or how they make decisions on where to give. How do you advise them with regard to that?
Every family is different. So depending on what the family's needs are, I've got lots of resources to bring to the table so that they can start to think really deeply about what their goals are. A lot of times we talk about values in families, and one of the really interesting things that I've uncovered is that across generations, family values tend to be inculcated really deeply, and they don't diverge. What does change is how they're contextualized. And so there's a lot of thinking about what is the emerging generation think about the way the founding generation has been giving over time. And it may be that they want to dive down deeper. They tend to be less involved in galas and fundraisers and more involved in finding out information about an organization and thinking about how to use other resources, not just financial resources, but really help build capacity in organizations. So that thread is a really interesting one. Years ago, Stephen Covey wrote this book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And the first habit is to be proactive. And the second habit, and this is my favorite, is to begin with the end in mind. So often I speak at conferences, the Society of Trust and Estate Planners, or to insurance conferences, or to groups of ultra high net worth families at wealth management conferences. And people will come up to me and say, so should we start a private foundation, or should we start a nonprofit because we care about this issue and raise money, or should we just put our money into a donor advised fund? And that, to me, is not the first question. The first question is, what change do you want to see in the world? And then once you've identified that, how do you then set up a structure that aligns with that mission? Many high net worth families have multiple sources of philanthropic capital. It's not just a donor advised fund or a private foundation. There may be trusts in place. There may be endowments at universities or schools or at hospitals. And rolling all of that up really helps a family understand what they've done in the past and gives them a platform to continue to build on and to think about how the world is evolving and how those family values have evolved over time.
You mentioned private foundations versus donor advised funds. Would you talk just for a minute about the distinction between the two and which clients might be better suited for either?
So it's a really important distinction, and it comes down to responsibility. So a board of directors, a board of trustees of a private foundation has fiduciary responsibility over the funding that's in that private foundation. And a donor advised fund doesn't. The fiduciary is either the community foundation or the wealth management group or the individual organization like a faith-based organization or a hospital or a university that hosts the donor advised fund. So ultimately, those organizations that are the hosts have the last say in how the money's used. And I think people sometimes get confused about that. So choosing the right donor advised fund is a really important thing if that's where you want to put your money. Private foundations have a mandate to distribute 5%. Donor advised funds right now don't. However, people who have money in donor advised funds tend to be distributing upwards of 20% of the fund every year, where private foundations more often, and not always, but more often are set up in perpetuity. So they're set up to continue giving money across generations. Both a private foundation and a donor advised fund donor gets the tax advantage in the year that they make the donation. So there's no distinction there. If you put money into a donor advised fund or into a private foundation, your tax advantage is when you put it into that structure, and it's not when that structure gives the money to a nonprofit organization or puts it out into the field. So that's the same. One really interesting issue that's come up through some research that was done by the Lilly School of Family Philanthropy in conjunction with Bank of America, they put out a biennial report called High Net Worth Giving, is that only 17% of the respondents in this last survey of high net worth donors said that it was really important, like it was primarily important to get the tax advantage in philanthropy. So 17% of respondents noted that tax efficiency was the most important motivator. And that's relatively low. It continues to drop year over year. While tax efficiency is still important, it's not the driving motivator.
Well, that's very interesting because we've also noticed that high net worth individuals seem to be picking up more of the slack in giving to charities. We've seen over the last 20 years or so a decline in the number of people donating to charities. And that has been concerning to me. So while we have had this decline in the number of people giving money to charities, we've seen actually the amount of money going to charities go up. So it's obviously the wealthier people that seem to be giving more. And it's really, I guess, a positive story that they don't find the tax issues as important. They're not motivated as much by that. They're motivated by changing society, hopefully in a positive way. But I do wonder, Karen, and I don't know if you do too, if there's a cost associated with the loss of donors, everyday people on the lower end who seem to have moved away from giving in that manner.
You know, Art, I think this is a really important time for people to give in a variety of ways, but it's reflective of the shifts in our society where the wealthier people continue to get wealthier. And what we're seeing, and this is something that we're seeing now in particular because of the pandemic, we're seeing people waiting in food lines who are the people who were totally self-sufficient prior to the pandemic. And this is, you know, this is of primary concern. So people who are waiting in lines at food banks might be the person who was doing your hair. It might be your barber. It might be someone who was singing in the opera. It might be an actor. They're librarians. They're people who wouldn't have typically had to wait in line at a food bank who are now just scratching for everything they can get. And they may also have been the donors. So we have a lot of work to do to right our society. And I think that it's incumbent on high net worth people to understand that there's an enormous need out there right now. And there's lots of ways to fix this. And it's going to take all of us.
Karen, you know, one of the questions that comes to mind, especially now since you mentioned the pandemic, is how families choose what to give their resources to. And I think about this now, especially because even though a family may have had a particular philanthropic orientation, the pandemic may have caused that to shift somewhat. And I know you're involved in arts organizations to some extent. And I just wonder if people are saying, you know, we do need to give more money to food banks because there's a lot more people out there now that are hungry and will shift our philanthropy somewhat to those types of organizations. Are you seeing that, or in general, how do you advise them to choose a particular type of philanthropic organization or cause?
It's such a good question, Art, and these are such troubling times. Families that have a strategy and have been following a particular strategy, and we need to just take a step back and say, just because a family, philanthropic family that's been engaged for a long time has a strategy doesn't mean that they don't have discretionary funding for other things. So those two things aren't mutually exclusive. But within the context of that strategy, to think about where the needs are. So let's say you fund arts organizations. Let's say you fund theater organizations. What are the immediate needs of those organizations because there aren't any performances right now? Are there technological needs? You know, is there a way to help those organizations put their art online so people have access to it in different ways? There are needs to support the artists. Because the artists are struggling individually because their craft has been waylaid. So how do you support the artists? So thinking about giving differently, but within the same context. And the same thing rings true in direct services organizations. Clients who focus on mental health issues or on youth and homelessness issues can start to help the organizations build capacity to respond to the problem in a way that they haven't had to before, right? So that might mean more supportive housing. It might mean more housing, period, because people have to distance in new ways. You know, it may mean making sure that there are crisis hotlines that are supported. And all of that can be done with less red tape than we typically use to think strategically. And it can be done nimbly. So as I mentioned before, there are no natural predators. That families have the opportunities to make their own, create their own boundaries, or to dismantle those boundaries in order to get money out of the door faster. And we see that happening. And then, of course, the immediate needs, just looking around your own geography and saying, okay, how do I help the people who are struggling right now? Is it food banks? Is it making sure that transitional housing is available for people who need transitional housing? Is it, you know, is it supporting the arts in my community? Because the ecosystem is so connected, Art. It's amazing to think about what's happening right now because the arts organizations in cities that have closed down are hurting the economies of the cities. They're hurting the restaurants. It hurts everyone who lives in the city. So what we need to do is get our cultural assets back up and running so that people are attracted to come back and engage in the ecosystem of the community. And philanthropy can't fix that, but it can be a catalyst, right? And philanthropists who are thinking together, families who fund the same things have the opportunities through a number of associations and peer groups to get together and think strategically about how we solve this problem now and what our response is going to be and how we right what's fallen apart.
That's wonderful. Do you see differences in generations and how they give? Are younger people thinking differently about where they give their money than maybe previous generations?
It's not necessarily where, although where is important, but certainly how. So younger people are, emerged younger generations are thinking about how they use all their assets and not just philanthropic assets. You know, we were set up decades ago in a situation where we had verticals. There's a philanthropic vertical and there's a capital vertical, a private vertical. And really they converge. And I see more and more energy going into thinking about how to solve problems and make money at the same time. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. So philanthropic giving can certainly complement impact investments, right? And investing in communities to make the ecosystems of those communities stronger can be financially rewarding for the people who do it, if they do it well. So that's one trend that I think is incredibly important and is kind of the backbone of change in our society. I also see, as mentioned before, this contextualization of ideas that the emerging generation has brought. So let's say that the founding generation of a business, it's maybe this founding generation's in their 70s or 80s right now, and they have always given to a cardiac unit at this hospital. And it's really important. They've gone to the galas, they've sat on the board, and this particular hospital's cardiac unit is utmost importance to the family, in part because the patriarch had originally passed away from a heart attack. And so they want to focus on cardiac health. Well, the emerging generations are saying, well, great, this hospital's doing wonderful work. What we really want to know is what's the research on cardiac health? What's changed since we started to invest in this particular hospital? What are the metrics? What's actually, who else is working in this space? So it may not be just supporting the institution. It may be elevating the issue that they care about and learning as much as they can about that issue. And then thinking about ways to engage. It may include the hospital, likely includes the hospital, but may also be investments in research that's happening at universities or in biotech. So there's a broadening of thinking about those issues happening right now. We are at this amazing moment in philanthropy where people are seeing that we've got to gather together to create change in order to move this world forward, in order to keep ourselves strong.
I've said many times, Karen, that charities are no longer the sole province of social good. We see even Fortune 500 companies focusing on the impact they can make on society while they return value to their shareholders. And so it's not surprising to see families now also looking at how they can make a difference, not only in giving away money, but also in investing in institutions or startups or what have you that will deliver bottom line financially and socially. So that's a great point you're making there. Let's shift for a minute to the pandemic. I hope that we're coming out of it in some ways, although some days I wake up and I feel like, you know, we're still at the bottom. We're not quite at the bottom of it yet. But the fact that we now have an injection that people can get that will reduce the impact of COVID is certainly hopeful. And that more and more people are getting that vaccine is certainly positive. But it's also, I would think, created, the pandemic itself has created an environment that we might often consider to be almost like a disaster area. Many communities are hit so hard by this across the country, and many types of workers are disproportionately affected by the pandemic. The pandemic has not had an equal distribution in terms of the effects that it's had on people. You mentioned before that some people have actually made more money during the pandemic than before, while other people have almost lost everything. So what should we all be thinking about in terms of supporting those in our country and our societies and our communities as a result of the pandemic?
No, Art, this pandemic has just elevated issues that have been festering for years. And the inequity, the lack of equity that the pandemic has exposed, has, along with what happened in June, the death of George Floyd, has really brought to the surface an enormous number of inequities in our country that people are paying really close attention to right now. And I think that it's time for us to think more deeply about that and to take action and to become more of an anti-racist society, to understand our privilege, to understand what's happened in the past and move forward with a new lens. I think that the equity issues related to the pandemic are really horrible. And you see that just in terms of the number of white people being vaccinated versus the number of BIPOC people being vaccinated and what's happening in communities. I know people who have gone into communities of color, white people who've gone into communities of color to get vaccinated because they're available and they are navigating the system in that way. And there's just a lot of old baggage, too, about fear of vaccinations, you know, that goes way back to Tuskegee and the experiments done in Tuskegee. So we have a lot of healing to do in this country. And maybe this pandemic has just ripped open the wounds so that we have an opportunity to understand better and to do some of that healing.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, let's hope that we can all, with sober eyes, understand the negative consequences associated with racism and that we will want to work together as a nation to begin to heal some of the wounds caused by it. Karen, let me just ask you, if you don't mind, to help us understand how in the world you chose philanthropic advising as a career. What was in your background that led you in this direction?
Well, I was really blessed to have the opportunity. Oprah used to say that luck is when opportunity meets preparation. And I was in a position to go to work for the Oprah Winfrey Show and help create a back office operation for Oprah's Angel Network, which was a public charity that developed on the Oprah Winfrey Show. I think it started in 1998, and I went in 2000 and really helped escalate the Oprah's Angel Network and then help build the Oprah Winfrey Foundations while I was there. And it was just a remarkable experience. You know, if you go back a little bit farther, I had grandparents who gave of themselves on a regular basis. My grandmother worked through her networks and helped people as much as she could. And my grandfather would go into senior centers and ask the people in the senior centers what they needed. And he would come back at Christmas time and deliver gifts to people. So I had this basis, and my parents would work for Community Chest and go out and ask people if they could contribute to the Community Chest, which, you know, moved into the United Way and community foundations. So this was just part of my DNA. And it's something I love helping people think about how they can have purpose in their lives. And working with Oprah did that for me.
Yeah, purpose in their lives. That's a really important statement, I think, because many people go through their lives. Some are fortunate enough to earn huge sums of money. And I understand that that alone doesn't generally give them purpose. And it's not till later on that they understand that there's more that they can do for humankind. And it's nice that there are people like you around. In your conversations with people who are just getting started along this path, does that seem to come out, or are there other sort of motivations, sort of like the one you just mentioned, which is, you know, it's just part of our family DNA. It's part of our family values that we do this. Maybe it's both.
Well, you know, I mentor a lot of younger people and early mid-career people who are thinking about nonprofit work or work in philanthropic organizations. And often they're coming at the work either because of social justice issues that they had experienced early in life. Sometimes it's lived experience and thinking about how to do better. But almost always there's a grandmother or a parent who showed them the way, or a pastor or a rabbi, so someone who, and often it's multiple people who just help motivate them early on. But I want to touch on something you just mentioned, which was the value of making a lot of money and what that does to families. And it's not always a positive thing. So there are families that come into a lot of money. Sometimes that money passes from one generation to another, and it can be really detrimental. And we see that play out publicly in large families all the time, right? Where the second or third generation is plagued by drug problems or conspicuous consumption. That doesn't satisfy purpose. Showing someone that you can have more than someone else has is not something it's not a feeling that's sustainable. You know, I've done some work with athletes and heard from someone who's talking about athletes who are given contracts in the NFL often go into a hotel room and the manager's there and some jeweler comes and lays jewelry out all over the bed and says, pick whatever you want, right? And this may have been an athlete who came from very little growing up. And just their purpose in their lives was building their bench strength and building support and building their athletic ability. And that's all they focused on. And now they can have whatever they want. And the question is, how many cars do they need? And what about the community they came from? Right? Because we aren't here in an isolated way. We are the product of where we came from. And we're going to be the incentive for the next generation. So just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to be happy, right? It's about how you use that money to help other people, to create purpose, to build a better world, to build a better community, to strengthen all of us.
Well, you know, Oprah was certainly a great example for us on many fronts. Those of us who watched her show for many years always came away with a warm feeling because of either her guests or how she led the show that particular evening. And, you know, to see some of her philanthropic success and her philanthropic orientation was also so refreshing and was an example, I think, for those of us further down, of course, on the economic rungs of society to also contribute and give back. But she was someone we could cheer for, not only in her obvious career success, but in the things that she supported. I'm just curious, from your vantage point, being there with her, how you were able to help her think through what might be best appropriate, or how does she gather her philanthropic causes and support? What motivated her to do the kinds of philanthropic activity that she did?
Well, a couple of things are, one is people using their lives to make the world a better place was a motivator for Oprah's Angel Network. And every week we would, for several years, we would highlight an individual who founded an organization to help other people. And often those organizations had multiple beneficiaries. So for example, I remember one organization that took young people who had been incarcerated and taught them how to train seeing eye dogs. And the young people would spend in detention centers, they would spend months teaching this dog how to help another person, and then they'd have to let the animal go so that the animal could go to its client, and then they would take another animal. And that kind of connection, that kind of compassion was able to build in people who had been deprived of it for such a long time. So that motivation was really big. But on another note, I remember very early how thrilled we were to get accreditation from Wise Giving. From the BBB's Wise Giving. And I think it was in the early 2000s. And that was something that was very important to us.
I remember that. I remember you going through that process. And we were all very gratified that your institution decided that it was worth doing. And it gave us a sort of pat on the back for actually producing something that someone of your philanthropic stature would view as valuable. It was great for us too. Karen, you've done a number of things in your life, but you also seem to have this orientation toward arts and arts organizations. And I know that right now you are part of the Poetry Foundation. And I would love to understand how that connection became a part of your life and why poetry in particular is important to you.
You know, the Poetry Foundation is a really fascinating place. And I remember being and working with Oprah in the early 2000s and reading an article in the Chronicle of Philanthropy about this bequest that Ruth Lilly had left the Poetry Foundation. And the Poetry Foundation, the Poetry Magazine, was essentially operating on fumes out of a top floor of a library, but putting out a magazine that had a very strong readership. And Ruth Lilly, who was never published in the magazine, left the Poetry Foundation quite a significant endowment. So reading about that made me think at the time, wow, this is going to be so fascinating to watch, because now all of a sudden they are super well-resourced. What are they going to do with it? And they had a number of wonderful things happen, but a lot of challenges over the course of years. But we currently have a marquee building here in Chicago that houses one of the largest poetry libraries in the world. We have a performance space where poets come, and sometimes we have jazz musicians come in and perform their poetry. We give awards. We've got a number of podcasts. I was really honored to be tapped on the shoulder and asked to sit on the board of the Poetry Foundation, and it was really a lovely experience up until June 6, when George Floyd's murder motivated people to say, wait a second, this organization needs to change. And then I was tapped on the shoulder again to become the chair of the board and do some work with the Poetry Foundation to lead it to be an anti-racist organization and to think more about equity issues in the arts. Funding in the arts is a really interesting space to work in, part because some people want to fund art so that it's in museums and performances that can be seen and to really elevate the level of the art. And there are other funders who are really concerned about using art to help young people develop, right? And to help young people learn and to go into communities and zip codes where there aren't the kinds of arts programs or the kinds of engagement or motivation that help young people really understand who they are. And the Poetry Foundation is a foundation that does that. We have a program called Poetry Out Loud that's a national competition in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Arts that works in high schools and across the country to engage young people in learning about great poets and in recitation. So that's something that really drew me to the organization as well.
Well, you know, arts organizations are so important to our culture. They help us understand the world around us. The artists are always great in interpreting what they're seeing and giving us a sense even of the past and the future. I just wonder, Karen, if, as you say, the Poetry Foundation is undergoing some changes to become more anti-racist, if one of the challenges might be what we're seeing in our society, this great debate right now that's going on between freedom of speech and expression versus harmful speech, and how the Poetry Foundation might be in some ways wrestling with that as well.
We hold ourselves accountable. There was a call to action. 1,800 poets signed a letter to the Poetry Foundation saying, get your house in order. Take a look at your practices and come up a couple of levels. Figure out how you can use the Poetry Foundation to generate equity in this conversation. And it really goes back to the conversation we were having before about the inequities that have been uncovered during the pandemic. So we embarked on a number of things that I think were really important following this call to action. We're making the foundation more inclusive, diverse, equitable, responsible, and compassionate. And that's in response to a letter that we received on June 6th. And if you go to poetryfoundation.org, you can see the community letter and the response that was written by both the staff and the board to the community. So we were charged to do more and do better. And we've got these essentially 7 steps that we've undertaken. So the staff has been invited to join communities and is engaged and devoted to action based on the letter of commitment. The board committed to broadening engagement with the poetry communities it serves, including the staff, and to increased transparency about our activities and being more a part of the community as opposed to kind of this ivory tower. Number three was equity oversight and audit. We instituted an equity oversight committee that's a permanent standing committee of the board, and we're engaged in an equity audit and we'll release the data from that audit later this year. Grant making. So we didn't talk about structures, art, but the Poetry Foundation is a private operating foundation. So that's different from a private foundation. And our goal is to fund activities like awards, like competitions, block parties. We engage communities in building poetry. And the magazine is part of that. The podcasts are part of that. So we're like an educational organization as a private operating foundation. So we do make grants, but that's not our main function. We've given $1 million over 2 years to support individual poets and writers, as well as organizations. We're committed to anti-racism. That's number 5. And we're applying an anti-racist and DEI lens across every area of work. And then number 6 is leadership and hiring. We've reevaluated how we execute job searches. We're looking at broad and diverse applicant pools of candidates and people who share a deep commitment to diversity, equity, and building a culture of inclusion and engaging our communities, as well as a passion, and this one's really important, a passion for poetry and supporting poets. So you can find more information about all of that specific work at poetryfoundation.org.
Well, that's wonderful. Because again, there are so many talented people across our country and in our communities that I think could thrive in this genre of art. Poetry ultimately is a visceral sort of expression of what we see in our society and what we hope to become. And so I do hope that there are new ways of connecting poetry with communities and with people who are sort of the arbiters of what is happening in these communities. I also hope that arts organizations in general can find ways to become more accessible. And I know that there are movements among museums, among performing arts institutions to try to do that. And I hope that continues. We have to, of course, recognize and appreciate how these organizations were founded and the art that they supported when they came into existence, the cultures that they were upholding. But we also need to find ways to appreciate and to grow into a new century, into a new world, into a new environment that we now find ourselves in, that is going to be more inclusive and just. So I definitely am thankful that you're at the helm of at least the Poetry Foundation, and you're now part of a community of arts that are driving our society in that direction. Karen, let me ask you, if you don't mind, to just give me your sense of the future. You're around people of significant wealth, in some cases enormous wealth. You're connected to organizations that sort of communicate what's going on in our society. What do you see going forward? Should we be optimistic, particularly now that we've seen that we're such a polarized society? Or should we be more concerned that there are these challenges that we may not be able to overcome?
We should be proactive. We should be proactive, empathetic, compassionate. And I'm not sure it falls along the binary of optimism or pessimism. We just need to take action. And people need to engage the level that they can engage. And sometimes that just starts with understanding what your resources are. I know very, very small foundations or people who give without actually having a structure who are catalytic in society because they've figured out the problem that they want to solve, focused on it, taken a look at the broader landscape, and taken action. If we can be significant motivators in changing our society, right, we're not going to solve problems. It's even talked about in the Bible that it's not our responsibility to solve problems, but it is our responsibility to be good stewards from one generation to another generation. The problems of our world are huge, and sometimes they can be really daunting, and pessimism may come out of that. But the opportunity for us to take action and be good stewards of our time is something that we really need to pay attention to.
So one of the things you and I are connected to, and I'm connected through your good offices, is the Rand Paradis School.
Yes.
And I want to talk a bit about that because of what you just mentioned, which is that we should be proactive. And Rand Paradis is focused on getting policy into communities and getting people of those communities to help create policy so that they can be agents of change, so that they can be proactive. Would you want to talk? And one day we'll get some of the people, good people from Rand Paradis on, but I'd love for you to talk about your experiences with this institution and why it's so important to our society.
So the Paradis Rand Graduate School of Public Policy is an offshoot of the Rand Institution. They only give PhDs in public policy. So as you can imagine, I love to be around people who are smarter than I am and who think really deeply and help motivate me to think about things I wouldn't have thought about otherwise. And so these are just super smart people. And as they were thinking about what can they do to create some equity and to combat racism in our society, their thinking was to democratize access to public policy. And how could they do that? They created a program called the Faculty Leaders Program that takes professors across disciplines. So you can be a chemistry professor or an English lit professor or an African studies professor and be selected for this program to learn about public policy. And then you take the public policy knowledge back to your community. And the people who are involved in the programs are people who are coming out of HBCUs, mostly underserved HBCUs, historically indigenous colleges and universities, and historically Latinx colleges and universities. So they're people who may not have had access to public policy that then can go back and think about policy at a community level. Many of these folks are sitting on the school boards, you know, or becoming part of their local community. But the opportunity for people to have access to understand and to develop public policy in their own communities starts to build a chain of equity. And so I think it's a really important program. Susan Marquis is the dean at the Paradis Rand Graduate School and has been working on this program for a while. So it's an exciting program.
Well, you're also involved in educating the next generation of philanthropic leaders. And what are you seeing among those you're teaching?
Yeah, commitment to change and some indignation. You know, how could you as a generation have left us where we are? Mm. You know, we've got bigger problems than we did before. I'm not sure that's true. They may be more exposed now. We're certainly more aware of climate change than we were 30 years ago, but it's not that it didn't exist. It's just farther along. And the same with issues related to equity. You know, I think there's more of a call to action, and it's more about using all of our resources. It's about our intellectual resources, our networks, our social equity, our communities, our financial resources, our time. It all goes together.
Well, Karen, to conclude our interview today, I want to take you back to Stephen Covey. And I know that in the book you mentioned, one of the things he asks his readers to do is to imagine, and I hope you don't think this to be too morbid, But to imagine that you're at your funeral, and what is it that you would want people to say about you at your funeral?
Boy, Art, I'm more of an existentialist than that. I haven't gotten there yet. I do have a quote for you, though.
Okay.
So maybe this is an epitaph that would work. This is a quote from a poem that was written by Joy Harjo, who's the first Native American poet laureate. She's currently, in an unprecedented way, serving her third term as poet laureate. She's appointed by the Library of Congress, and she's just amazing. This quote is from the collection of poems she wrote called The Woman Who Fell from the Stars, and the poem is called Reconciliation, a Prayer Poem. And the quote is, "All acts of kindness are lights in the war for justice."
Wonderful. Well, this is the Heart of Giving podcast, and I've had the pleasure of interviewing Karen Yanis. I hope you'll listen to our next episode. You can subscribe to us on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.